lack of pigment in the iris. As everybody knows, skin color changes, to some extent, in response to sun exposure. The trigger for that response is the pituitary gland. Under natural circumstances, almost as soon as you are exposed to the sun, your pituitary gland produces hormones that act as boosters for your melanocytes, and your melanocytes start producing melanin on overdrive. Unfortunately, it's very easy to disrupt that process. The pituitary gland gets its information from the optic nerve. When the optic nerve senses sunlight, it signals the pituitary gland to kickstart the melanocytes. Guess what happens when you're wearing sunglasses? Much less sunlight reaches the optic nerve, much less warning is sent to the pituitary gland, much less melanocyte-stimulating hormone is released, much less melanin is produced, and much more sunburn results. If you're reading this on the beach with your Ray-Bans on, do your skin a favor. Take them off. Tanning helps people cope with seasonal differences in sunlight in their ancestral climate. It's not enough protection for a Scandinavian at the equator. Someone like that, with very little natural ability to tan and regular unprotected exposure to tropical sun, is vulnerable to severe burning, premature aging, and skin cancer, as well as folic acid deficiency and all its associated problems. And the consequences can be deadly. More than 60,000 Americans are diagnosed with melanoma, an especially aggressive type of skin cancer, every year. European Americans are 10 to 40 times as likely to get melanoma as African Americans. As humanity was evolving, we probably had pretty light skin, too, underneath a similar coat of coarse, dark hair. As we lost hair, the increased exposure of our skin to ultraviolet rays from the strong African sun threatened the stores of folate we need to produce healthy babies. And that created an evolutionary preference for darker skin, full of light-absorbing, folate-protecting melanin. As some population groups moved northward, where sunlight was less frequent and less strong, that dark skin, designed to block UVB absorption, worked too well. Now, instead of protecting against the loss of folate, it was preventing the creation of vitamin D. And so the need to maximize the use of available sunlight in order to create sufficient vitamin D created a new evolutionary pressure, this time for lighter skin. Recent scientific sleuthing reported in the prestigious journal Science goes so far as to say that white-skinned people are actually black-skinned mutants who lost the ability to produce significant amounts of eumelanin. Redheads, with their characteristic milky white skin and freckles, may be a further mutation along the same lines. In order to survive in places with infrequent and weak sunlight, such as parts of the UK, they may have evolved in a way that almost completely knocked out their body's ability to produce eumelanin, the brown or black pigment. In 2000, an anthropologist named Nina G. Jablonski and a geographic computer specialist named George Chaplin combined their scientific disciplines, after already combining their lives and marriage, to chart the connection between skin color and sunlight. The results were as clear as the sky on a cloudless day. There was a near-constant correlation between skin color and sunlight exposure in populations that had remained in the same area for 500 years or more. They even produced an equation to express the relationship between a given population's skin color and its annual exposure to ultraviolet rays. If you're feeling adventurous, the equation is W equals 70 minus AUV over 10. W represents relative whiteness, and AUV represents annual ultraviolet exposure. The 70 is based on research that indicates that the whitest possible skin, the result of a population that received zero exposure to UV, would reflect about 70% of the light directed at it. Interestingly, their research also proposes that we carry sufficient genes within our gene pool to ensure that, within 1,000 years of a population's migration from one climate to another, its descendants would have skin color dark enough to protect folate, or light enough to maximize vitamin D production. There is one notable exception to Jablonski and Chaplin's equation, and it's the exception that proves the rule. The Inuit, the indigenous people of the subarctic, are dark-skinned, despite the limited sunlight of their home. If you think something fishy is going on here, you're right. But the reason they don't need to evolve the lighter skin necessary to ensure sufficient vitamin D production is refreshingly simple. Their diet is full of fatty fish, which just happens to be one of the only foods in nature that is chock full of vitamin D. They eat vitamin D for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, so they don't need to make it. If you ever had a grandmother from the old world try to force cod liver oil down your throat, she was onto something for the same reason. Since it's full of vitamin D, cod liver oil was one of the best ways to prevent rickets, especially before milk was routinely fortified with it. If you're wondering how people who have dark skin make enough vitamin D, despite the fact that their skin blocks all those ultraviolet rays, you're asking the right questions. Remember, ultraviolet rays that penetrate the skin destroy folate, and ultraviolet rays that penetrate the skin are necessary to create vitamin D. Dark skin evolved to protect folate, but it didn't evolve with a switch. You can't turn it off when you need to whip up a batch of vitamin D. So that would seem to create a new problem for people with dark skin, even if they lived in a sunny climate, because even though they received plenty of exposure to ultraviolet rays, the skin color that protected their supply of folate would prevent them from stocking up on vitamin D. It's a good thing evolution's such a clever sort, because it took that into account. It kept room for a little guy called apolipoprotein E, ApoE4, in the gene pool of dark-skinned population groups. And guess what ApoE4 does? It ensures that the amount of cholesterol flowing through your blood is cranked up. With more cholesterol available for conversion, dark-skinned people can maximize the use of whatever sunlight penetrates their skin. Much farther to the north, without a similar adaptation, the light-skinned people of Europe would face a similar problem. There, instead of plenty of sunlight that was largely blocked by dark skin, they had to deal with too little sunlight to make enough vitamin D, even with the benefit of their light skin. And sure enough, ApoE4 is also common throughout northern Europe. The farther north you go up the continent, the more you'll find it. As it does in Africans, the ApoE4 gene keeps cholesterol levels cranked up, allowing its carriers to compensate for limited ultraviolet exposure by maximizing the cholesterol available for conversion to vitamin D. Of course, in characteristic evolutionary fashion, ApoE4 comes with a trade-off. The ApoE4 gene and all the extra cholesterol that accompanies it put people at greater risk for heart disease and stroke. In Caucasians, it even carries a higher risk for development of Alzheimer's disease. And as you've seen with iron loading and diabetes, one generation's evolutionary solution is another generation's evolutionary problem, especially when people no longer live in the environment that their bodies adapted to through evolution. If you want a funny-sounding example of an environmental defense turned environmental hazard, you need look no further than your nose. Achu syndrome, its full name is autosomal dominant compelling helio-ophthalmic outburst syndrome, is the name of a disorder that causes uncontrolled sneezing when someone is exposed to bright light, usually sunlight, after being in the dark. Well, way back when our ancestors spent more time in caves, this reflex helped them to clear out any molds or microbes that might have lodged in their noses or upper respiratory tract. Today, of course, when someone is driving through a dark tunnel and emerges into the bright sun and gets a sneezing fit, achoo isn't helpful or funny at all. It can be downright dangerous. But before we examine more instances of the effect a new environment has on old adaptations, let's take a look at another example of different population groups taking divergent evolutionary paths, this time not just for environmental reasons, but for cultural reasons too. If you're of Asian descent and have ever had an alcoholic beverage, there's a 50-50 chance your heart rate shot up, your temperature climbed, and your face turned bright red. If you're not Asian, but you've ever been in a bar frequented by people with an Asian background, chances are you've seen this reaction. It's called Asian flush, or more formally, alcohol flush response. It happens to as many as half of all people of Asian descent, but it's uncommon in just about every other population group. So what's the story? When you consume alcohol, your body detoxifies it and then extracts calories from it. It's a complex process that involves many different enzymes and multiple organs, although most of the process takes place in the liver. First, an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase converts the alcohol into another chemical called acetaldehyde. Another enzyme, cleverly called acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, converts the acetaldehyde into acetate. And a third enzyme converts that into fat, carbon dioxide, and water. The calories synthesized from alcohol are generally stored as fat. Beer bellies really do come from beer. Many Asians have a genetic variation, labeled ALDH22, that causes them to produce a less powerful form of acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, one that isn't as effective in converting acetaldehyde, that first byproduct of alcohol, into acetate. Acetaldehyde is 30 times as toxic as alcohol. Even very small amounts can produce nasty reactions. And one of those reactions is the flushing response. That's not all it does, of course. After even one drink by people who have the ALDH22 variation, the acetaldehyde buildup causes them to appear drunk. Blood rushes to their face, chest, and neck. Dizziness and extreme nausea set in, and the drinker is on the road to a nasty hangover. Of course, there's a side benefit to all of this. People who have ALDH22 are highly resistant to alcoholism. It's just too unpleasant for them to drink. In fact, the resistance to alcoholism is so strong in people with ALDH22 that doctors often prescribe alcoholics a drug called disulfiram, which essentially mirrors the ALDH22 effect. Disulfiram, antabuse, interferes with the body's own supply of the acetaldehyde dehydrogenase enzyme. So anyone who drinks alcohol while taking it ends up with something that looks an awful lot like Asian flush and feels truly awful to boot. So why is the ALDH22 variation so common among Asians and virtually non-existent among Europeans? It's all about clean water. As humans began to settle in cities and towns, they got their first taste of the sanitation and waste management problems that still plague cities today, but without even the possibility of modern plumbing. This made clean water a real challenge. And some theories suggest that different civilizations came up with different solutions. In Europe, they used fermentation, and the resulting alcohol killed microbes, even when, as was often the case, it was mixed with water. On the other side of the world, people purified their water by boiling it and making tea. As a result, there was evolutionary pressure in Europe to have the ability to drink, break down, and detoxify alcohol, while the pressure in Asia was a lot less. Alcohol isn't the only beverage that requires some specific genetic mutation to enjoy, by the way. If you're reading this while sipping a latte or slurping an ice cream cone, you're a mutant. The great majority of the world's adults cannot eat or drink milk without experiencing a very unpleasant digestive reaction. Once they no longer feed on breast milk, their bodies stop producing the enzyme that we need to digest lactose, the main sugar compound in milk. But if you can drink milk without the characteristic bloating, cramping, and diarrhea that signifies lactose intolerance, you're a lucky mutant. You're probably descended from farmers who drank animal milk. Somewhere along the line, a mutation sprang up that allowed people to keep producing the lactose processing enzyme called lactase as adults. And that mutation spread throughout farming populations until it landed in your genome. People of African descent have darker skin and are much more likely to have a gene that causes them to produce greater amounts of cholesterol. People of Northern European descent have pale skin and are much more likely to have iron loading and a predisposition for type 1 diabetes. People of Asian descent are much more likely to be unable to process alcohol efficiently. Are those racial differences? It's not a question that can be easily answered. First of all, there's no real agreement as to what race means. On the genetic level, it's pretty clear that skin color isn't reliable. We've already discussed how the skin color of a transplanted population would change to match the level of ultraviolet exposure in its new environment. Recent genetic studies bear this out. In terms of common genetics, some dark-skinned North Africans are probably closer to light-skinned Southern Europeans than they are to other Africans with whom they share skin color. On the other hand, many Jews seem to share a distinct genetic heritage despite the fact that they may be fair, blonde, and blue-eyed, or dark, black-haired, and brown-eyed. This has been borne out by recent research as well. Jews divide themselves into three groups to preserve certain religious traditions. The groups are based on which biblical tribe they are descended from. The Kohanim are members of the priestly tribe that traces its roots to Moses' brother Aaron, the original high priest. Levites are descendants of the tribe of Levi, the traditional princes of the temple. Today, descendants of the other 12 tribes are simply called Israelites. A group of researchers recently compared the DNA of a large group of Kohanim to the DNA of a large group of Israelites. The researchers were stunned to discover that, despite being spread across the world, the genetic markers of the Kohanim were so specific that they were all almost certainly descended from just a few male individuals. They came from Africa, from Asia, from Europe, and though their appearance ran the gamut from light-skinned and blue-eyed to dark-skinned and brown-eyed, most of them shared very similar Y chromosome markers. This controversial data even allowed the researchers to estimate when the originators of the Kohanim genes were alive. According to the researchers, that would have been 3,180 years ago, between the exodus from Egypt and the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem, or exactly when Aaron walked the earth. Nature Genetics, a prominent journal, recently editorialized that population clusters identified by genotype analysis seem to be more informative than those identified by skin color or self-declaration of race. That makes a lot of sense. Instead of worrying about whether or not there are distinct races, let's concentrate on what we do know and use that to advance medical science. What we do know is that distinct populations do share distinct genetic heritages, which are almost certainly the result of different evolutionary pressures our various ancestors experienced as they settled and resettled across the globe. The current mainstream consensus is that modern humans evolved in Africa about 250,000 years ago. According to that theory, they migrated from Africa northward toward what is now the Middle East. Then some went right, populating India, the Asian coast, and ultimately the Pacific Islands. Other groups headed left, settling across Central Europe. Still others continued north, spreading across Central Asia, or venturing farther, by boat or by ice bridge, over the top of the world, and then down into North and South America. All of that migration probably took place within the last 100,000 years. Of course, we don't know for sure yet. It's also possible that humans evolved in multiple places, and that different groups of pre-humans and Neanderthals even interbred. Whatever the truth is, it's clear that as humanity evolved, different groups of humans encountered widely different circumstances, from infectious tropical diseases to sudden ice ages to pandemic plagues. The evolutionary pressure that accompanied all these challenges was probably intense enough to account for the differences we see between populations today. We've discussed a few examples, but the range is broad. Skull shape, for example, may have evolved as a mechanism to facilitate storage and release of heat, depending on a population's climate. Dense hair on the forearms and legs, the parts of the body usually exposed even with moderate dress, may have been a defense against malaria carried by mosquitoes. With the exception of Africa, where the heat was an evolutionary counterweight to thick body hair, the densest hair is generally found in the same places where malaria is most common, the eastern Mediterranean basin, southern Italy, Greece, and Turkey. In Africa, where the heat was an evolutionary argument against denser body hair, people are prone to sickle cell anemia, which, as we'll discuss, offers some protection from malaria. It's also important to remember that, in migratory terms, humanity has been on an express train for the last 500 years. The result, of course, is a blurring of genetic distinctions as people from different parts of the world meet and mate. Populations have always tended to combine genetic material, aka make babies, with nearby populations. But that genetic intermixing is taking place on a global scale today. In fact, genetic testing is revealing that the human population as a whole is already far more mixed than most people assume. Take Dr. Henry Louis Gates, for example, the distinguished scholar who is the chair of African and African American Studies at Harvard. Dr. Gates is black, but he and his family have long believed that they had at least one distant ancestor who wasn't black, most likely a former slave owner who was thought to have been involved with his great-great-grandmother. And then some genetic testing revealed that Dr. Gates had no relationship to the slave owner, but fully 50% of his genetic heritage was European. Half of his ancestors were white. Finally, we have to keep in mind that, in the right circumstances, heavy evolutionary pressure can breed a trait into or out of a population's gene pool in just a generation or two. When you combine the possibility of relatively fast changes in a given gene pool with the rapid migration of the last 500 years, you can understand that population subsets with distinct genetic traits can emerge pretty quickly. A controversial theory looks to a shameful period in our history to explain the high rate of high blood pressure among African Americans. High blood pressure, or hypertension, is a particularly insidious disease. It's responsible for as much as 25% of end-stage kidney failure. But it usually has no noticeable symptoms. That's why it's often called the silent killer. It is almost twice as common among African Americans as it is in the rest of the American population. Doctors first noticed the elevated incidence of high blood pressure in African Americans in the 1930s and assumed that all blacks shared a propensity for it. They were wrong. Blacks living in Africa do not have the same rate of hypertension as people of African descent in America. What's the explanation? You've probably heard that salt can raise your blood pressure. Research has demonstrated that this is especially true for African Americans. Their blood pressure is very reactive to salt. Now, salt also got a bad rap for a while, especially when it was first linked to high blood pressure. But it's a critical component of your body chemistry. It regulates fluid balance and nerve cell function. You can't survive without it. But when people who are especially reactive to it eat a diet high in salt, it can contribute to high blood pressure. When Africans were taken to America against their will by slave traders, they were transported under horrible conditions. They usually weren't fed or even given sufficient amounts of water. The death rate was very high. It's possible that those with a natural propensity to retain high levels of salt had a better chance to survive. The extra salt helped them to maintain enough water to avoid fatal dehydration. If that's true, you can see how the slave trade might have produced a very unnatural selection for an increased ability to retain salt in many African Americans. When you couple that ability with a modern diet high in salt, it results in increased rates of hypertension. From a medical perspective, it's clear that specific diseases are more prevalent in specific population groups in a way that is significant and deserves continued serious exploration. On a proportional basis, African Americans have almost twice as many fatal heart attacks as European and South Asian Americans. Their rate of cancer is 10% higher. European Americans are more likely to die of cancer and heart disease than Latino, Asian, or Native Americans. American Latinos are more likely to die of diabetes, liver disease, and infectious disease than non-Latinos. and Native Americans have higher rates of tuberculosis, pneumonia, and influenza. It seems like new examples crop up every month in the scientific literature. The most recent study discovered that African Americans who smoke a pack of cigarettes a day are far more likely to develop lung cancer than whites with the exact same habit. Now, these statistics don't necessarily tell the whole story. For starters, they don't always control for other differences in these groups that have nothing to do with genetics and evolution. Differences in diet and nutrition, environment, personal habits, and access to health care will all have an effect on these studies. But that doesn't mean we should ignore the large trends we see among different population groups. To the contrary, the more we understand how our evolution has shaped our genetic makeup, the more we can understand how to live a healthy life today. Let's take a look at a few examples. We've discussed two parallel adaptations to manage the sun's dueling effects on body chemistry: the evolution of dark skin to protect our stores of folate, and the evolution of a genetic trigger for increased cholesterol to maximize production of vitamin D. Both of these adaptations are common in people of African descent and are effective in the bright, strong sun of equatorial Africa. But what happens when people with those adaptations move to New England, where the sun is much less plentiful and far less strong? Without sufficient sunlight to penetrate their dark skin and convert the additional cholesterol, they're doubly vulnerable. Not enough vitamin D and too much cholesterol. Sure enough, rickets, the disease caused by a vitamin D deficiency that causes poor bone growth in children, was very common in African American populations until we started routinely fortifying milk with vitamin D in the last century. And there appear to be connections among sunlight, vitamin D, and prostate cancer in African Americans as well. There is growing evidence that vitamin D inhibits the growth of cancerous cells in the prostate and in other areas, including the colon too. Epidemiologists who specialize in unlocking the mystery of where, why, and in whom disease occurs have found that the risk of prostate cancer for black men in America climbs from south to north. When it comes to prostate cancer in black men, the risk is considerably lower in sunny Florida. But as you move north, the rate of prostate cancer in black men climbs until it peaks in the often cloud-covered heights of the Northeast. There is a growing belief among some researchers that a lack of vitamin D may also be one of the reasons we get sick more often in the winter than in the summer months. The combination of excess cholesterol and lack of exposure to sufficient sunlight may well be part of the reason that African Americans have such a high rate of heart disease. The ApoE4 gene keeps the blood full of cholesterol, even though there's not enough sunlight in a northern climate to convert it to vitamin D. As cholesterol builds up, it attaches to the walls of your arteries. Eventually, it can build up so much that it results in a blockage that causes a heart attack or stroke. The pharmaceutical industry has begun to take the genetic differences of populations into account. This study of how genetic variation can affect pharmaceutical treatment is called pharmacogenetics, and it's already producing results. There's a general consensus that some of the usual therapies for hypertension, for example, don't work as well for African Americans. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, recently approved a controversial drug called Bidil for self-identified black patients who have heart failure. New research has demonstrated that it's not just the presence of a specific genetic variation that can affect our body chemistry, and thus the way we respond to a given drug. It's how many times that gene occurs in our genome. In other words, it's quantity and quality. For example, a gene called CYP2D6 affects the way people metabolize more than 25% of all pharmaceuticals, including very common drugs like decongestants and antidepressants. People who have very few copies of this gene are called slow metabolizers. It's thought that up to 10% of Caucasians fall into this category, but only 1% of Asians fit the bill. If you've ever taken a standard dose of Sudafed and felt a tingling sensation and a rapid heartbeat, you're probably a slow metabolizer, and you should talk to your doctor about cutting your dosage. On the other end of the spectrum are ultra-rapid metabolizers. These folks can have as many as 13 copies of the CYP2D6 gene. Of Ethiopians, 29% are metabolizers on hyperspeed, compared to less than 1% of Caucasians. The more we learn about the way genetic makeup affects an individual's response to a given drug, the more it's clear that personalized medicine, where dosing and drugs are tailored to fit your genome, has the potential to provide significant health benefits. Scientists suspect that the presence and quantity of genes like CYP2D6 in different populations are related to the relative toxicity of a specific population's environment. Fast metabolizers can clear, detoxify, harmful substances more successfully. So the more toxins, from food, insects, whatever, in a particular environment, the more evolution favored multiple copies of toxin-clearing genes. Sometimes that fast metabolizing can be a problem, too. Some fast metabolizers actually convert certain drugs, like codeine, into much more potent forms. There was a recent report of a patient who became ill because she converted the codeine in her prescription cough syrup into morphine much faster than anyone expected. Sure enough, she was a CYP2D6 fast metabolizer. Another gene called CCR5 Delta-32 appears to prevent human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, from entering cells. One copy of this gene significantly hampers the virus's ability to multiply, reducing the viral load in people who carry the gene and become infected. And two copies of the gene? Almost complete immunity from HIV. Tragically, CCR5 Delta-32 is almost completely absent in Africans, where AIDS is epidemic, but it occurs in some 5 to 10% of Caucasians. Some researchers have suggested that CCR5 Delta-32 was selected for in the same way hemochromatosis was, because it offered some type of protection against the bubonic plague. But unlike hemochromatosis, no clear mechanism for this selection has been suggested. One thing is clear. There is mounting evidence that where our ancestors came from, how they adapted to manage their environment, and where we live today all combine to have a significant impact on our health. That understanding ought to inform everything from research in the laboratory to medical care in the doctor's office to life in our homes. Today, the most widely prescribed therapy for high cholesterol is a class of drugs called statins. Although they are considered generally safe drugs, over time statins can cause serious side effects, including liver damage. If you knew that you might be able to reduce your excess cholesterol by getting enough sunlight to convert it to vitamin D, wouldn't you rather hit the tanning salon before starting a lifetime of Lipitor? That's food for thought. Chapter 4. Hey, bud, can you do me a fava? A distinguished-looking man, debonair to his core in a way that the bright orange prison coveralls cannot obscure, stands in his jail cell looking out at an attractive brunette who has presumed to question him. She's testing him, and he's having none of it. A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti, says Hannibal Lecter. If the doctor they called the cannibal had been an epidemiologist instead of a psychiatrist, he might have killed his victim with those fava beans, not just served his liver with them. Before we started calling them fava beans, after the Italian word for them, we called them broad beans. And the range of legend that surrounds them is certainly broad. The Greek scholar Pythagoras supposedly warned a flock of future philosophers, "Avoid fava beans." Of course, since fava beans were used as ballots at the time, white for yes and black for no, he may have just been giving his students advice that all good philosophers should still ponder today. Avoid politics. In fact, the legends surrounding Pythagoras' warning are almost as varied as the legends around the bean itself. A different theory holds that Pythagoras' concern was something much less grave than possible poison and much less theoretical than possible politics. According to Diogenes, Pythagoras was just worried his students would eat too many beans and, well, pass too much gas. 2,000 years ago, Diogenes supposedly said, "One should abstain from fava beans, since they are full of wind and take part in the soul. And if one abstains from them, one's stomach will be less noisy, and one's dreams will be less oppressive and calmer." A cult called the Orphics believed that the fava plant contained the souls of the dead. According to them, eating fava beans and gnawing on the heads of one's parents are one and the same. Aristotle alone had 5 different theories about Pythagoras's broad beans, saying that Pythagoras warned against them, either because they have the shape of testicles, or because they resemble the gates of hell, for they alone have no hinges, or again because they spoil, or because they resemble the nature of the universe, or because of oligarchy, for they are used for drawing lots. It's no wonder all those ancient Greeks were philosophers. They clearly had a lot of time on their hands. But they weren't the only people to notice the mysterious reaction many people have to fava beans. In the 20th century, a school teacher in Sardinia, an island off the coast of Italy, is said to have noticed a seasonal lethargy that settled on her students every spring and lasted for weeks. Supposedly recalling Pythagoras's warning, she connected her students' nodding heads to flowering fava plants. Superstitions against eating uncooked fava beans were common throughout the Middle East. In Italy, fava beans are traditionally planted on All Souls' Day, and cakes shaped like a fava bean pod are called fave dei morti, beans of the dead. As you've probably come to suspect, where there's folklore smoke, there's medical fire. In the case of the fava bean, a whole lot of it. Favism, as modern medical science has so aptly labeled it, is an inherited enzyme deficiency carried by 400 million people. It's the most common enzyme deficiency in the world. In extreme cases, people who have favism and eat fava beans, or take certain drugs, experience rapid severe anemia that can often lead to death. Scientists first caught wind of the truth behind some people's deadly reaction to fava beans during the Korean War. Because malaria was common in parts of Korea, American soldiers who served there were prescribed anti-malarial drugs, including one called Primaquine. Doctors soon discovered that about 10% of African-American soldiers developed anemia while taking Primaquine. And some soldiers, especially those of Mediterranean descent, experienced an even more severe side effect called hemolytic anemia. Their red blood cells were literally bursting. In 1956, 3 years after the ceasefire that ended the Korean War, medical researchers isolated the cause of the soldiers' reaction to the anti-malarial drugs. They lacked sufficient amounts of an enzyme called glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, or G6PD for short. G6PD is thought to be present in every cell in the body. It's especially important in red blood cells, where it protects cellular integrity, mopping up chemical elements that would otherwise destroy the cell. You've probably heard about free radicals in the news and may have a general sense that they're not so good for you. The easiest way to understand free radicals is to remember that Mother Nature likes pairs. She's something of a chemical matchmaker. Free radicals are essentially molecules or atoms with unpaired electrons, and unpaired electrons look to pair up. Unfortunately, as far as your body is concerned, those electrons look for love in all the wrong places. As the unpaired electrons seek to pair with electrons in other molecules, they cause chemical reactions. Those reactions can disrupt cellular chemistry and lead to the cell's early death. That's one of the reasons free radicals are thought to be a major cause of aging. G6PD is like a bouncer in the red blood cell bar. When it's on the job, it throws out the free radicals so they can't start trouble. But when you don't have enough G6PD, any chemical that produces free radicals can wreak havoc on your red blood cells. That's what happened with the soldiers who experienced adverse reactions to Primaquine. One of the ways Primaquine stops the spread of malaria is by stressing your red blood cells and making them a generally unpleasant place for malaria-causing parasites. But if you don't have enough G6PD to maintain cellular integrity, when the primaquine puts stress on your red blood cells, some of the cells can't take it. The free radicals cause the cell membranes to burst, destroying them. And that loss of red blood cells spells anemia, specifically hemolytic anemia, which is anemia that is caused by the early breakdown of red blood cells. The person undergoing the hemolytic crisis will experience severe weakness and fatigue. There may be signs of jaundice. Untreated, hemolytic anemia can lead to kidney failure, heart failure, and death. Those ancient Greeks were onto something. For some people, fava beans are killers. They contain two sugar-related compounds called visine and convisine. Visine and convisine produce free radicals, especially hydrogen peroxide. When people who have favism eat fava beans, they undergo a reaction similar to the one that occurs after taking primaquine. If the hydrogen peroxide isn't cleared out with the help of G6PD, it starts to attack your red blood cells, ultimately breaking them down. When that happens, the rest of the cell leaks out, resulting in hemolytic anemia with potentially deadly effect. The gene that is responsible for G6PD protein production, or deficiency, goes by the same name, G6PD. This gene is carried on the X chromosome. As you probably remember from science class, the X chromosome is one of the two sex chromosomes. The other is Y. Humans with two X chromosomes, XX, are female. Humans with an X and a Y chromosome, XY, are male. Because the gene for G6PD deficiency is carried on the X chromosome, the condition is much more common in men. When a man has the mutation on his one X chromosome, all his cells take direction from that mutation. For a woman to have serious G6PD deficiency, she has to have the mutation on both X chromosomes. If she has it on only one chromosome, some of her red blood cells will have a normal gene and some won't, and she should produce sufficient G6PD to avoid favism. There are two normal versions of the G6PD gene, one called GDB and the other GDA+. There are more than 100 possible mutations of this gene, but they fit into two major categories, one that arose in Africa called GDA-, and one that arose around the Mediterranean called GDMed. These mutations cause serious problems only when free radicals start overwhelming your red blood cells and there isn't enough G6PD to clean them up. Problems can be triggered in people with favism by some infections and some medications, like primaquine, that release free radicals into the bloodstream. But as we've discussed, the most common trigger is eating fava beans, which is why it's called favism, of course. Humans have been cultivating fava beans for thousands of years. The oldest seeds found so far were discovered in an archaeological dig near Nazareth. They're thought to be around 8,500 years old, having been dated back to 6,500 BC. From Nazareth, in what is now the northern part of Israel, fava beans are thought to have spread throughout the Middle East and then north, around the eastern Mediterranean, into Turkey, across the Greek plains, and on into southern Italy, Sicily, and Sardinia. If you marked up a map to show where favism is most common, and then overlaid that with the areas where fava bean cultivation is most common, guess what? At this point, you may not be all that surprised at what I'm about to tell you. Favism genes and fava bean farms? Same places, same people. Favism is most common, and most deadly, in North Africa and Southern Europe, all around the Mediterranean, which happen to be exactly the places where fava beans are historically cultivated and consumed. Here we go again. Somehow, millions of humans have evolved with a genetic mutation that is only likely to cause problems when they eat something that is most common to the diet in their part of the world? Well, if we figured out anything so far, it's that evolution doesn't favor genetic traits that will make us sick unless those traits are more likely to help us before they hurt us. And a trait that is shared by more than 400 million people is definitely an evolutionary favorite. So there has to be some benefit to G6PD deficiency, right? Right. Before we dig further into the connection between favism and fava beans, let's take a look at the broader connection between evolution in the animal kingdom and evolution in the plant kingdom. We'll start with breakfast. You see that strawberry in your cereal? The vine it came from wants you to eat it. Plants that produce edible fruit evolved that way for their own benefit. Animals pick fruit and eat it. The fruit contains seeds. Animals walk or lope or swing or fly away, and eventually they deposit those seeds somewhere else, giving the plant a chance to spread and reproduce. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree unless an animal eats it and takes it for a ride. It's a gastronomic hitchhike, and it works well for everybody. In fact, that's why ripe fruit is easy to pick and often falls off, while unripe fruit is harder to harvest. The plant doesn't want you to take off with the fruit until the seeds within it have finished developing. No free lunch in Mother Nature's outdoor cafe. On the other hand, as much as plants want animals to eat their fruit, they don't want animals to get much closer than that. When creatures start to nibble on their leaves or gnaw at their roots, things can get tricky. So plants have to be able to defend themselves. Just because they're generally immobile doesn't mean they're pushovers. Thorns are plants' most obvious defense mechanisms, but they're by no means the only one or the most powerful. These guys have a whole arsenal. Plants, by far, are the biggest manufacturers of chemical weapons on Earth. Everybody knows about the beneficial effects we receive because of basic plant chemistry. They convert sunlight and water into sugar by using carbon dioxide they absorb from the atmosphere, in turn producing oxygen, which we get to breathe. But that's just the starting point. Plant chemistry has the power to make a significant impact on its environment, influencing everything from the weather to the number of local predators. Clover, sweet potato, and soy all belong to a group of plants that contain a class of chemicals called phytoestrogens. Sounds familiar, right? It should. Phytoestrogens mimic the effect of animal sex hormones, such as estrogen. When animals eat too much of a plant that contains phytoestrogens, the overload of estrogen-like compounds wreaks havoc on reproductive capability. There was a sheep breeding crisis in Western Australia during the 1940s. Otherwise, healthy sheep weren't getting pregnant or were losing their young before giving birth. Everyone was stumped until some bright agricultural specialists discovered the little culprit, European clover. This type of clover produces a potent phytoestrogen called formononatin as a natural defense against grazing predators. And yes, if you're a plant, a sheep is a predator. Accustomed to the humidity of Europe, the imported clover plants were struggling to cope with the drier Australian climate. When clover has a bad year, not enough rain or sunshine, or too much rain or sunshine, it protects itself by limiting the size of the next generation of predators. It increases production of formononatin and prevents the birth of baby grazers by sterilizing their would-be parents. The next time you're looking for some convenient birth control, you don't have to snack on a field of clover, of course. But if you take many forms of the famous pill, you're not doing something all that different. The gifted chemist Carl Gerassi based his development of the pill on just this kind of botanical birth control. He wasn't using clover, though. He was using sweet potatoes, the Mexican yam, to be exact. He started with desogenin, a phytoestrogen produced by the yam, and from that base, he synthesized the first marketable contraceptive pill in 1951. Yams aren't the only source of phytoestrogens in the human diet. Soy is rich in a phytoestrogen called genistein. It's worth noting that today many processed foods, including commercial baby formulas, use soy because it's an inexpensive source of nutrition. There's a growing concern among a small number of scientists that we don't have a handle on the potential long-term effects of what seems to be an ever greater level of phytoestrogens and soy in our diet. Plants are good at birth control, but they're great at poison. Most of the toxins they produce aren't directed at humans, of course. They don't really have to worry about us too much. The real problem that plants have is all those committed vegetarians grazing and buzzing and flying around that rely solely on them for food. But that doesn't mean we don't have to be careful, because plant toxins can cause lots of problems for us too. And chances are, you've probably eaten your fair share in the last week. Ever have tapioca pudding? Tapioca is made from the cassava plant. Cassava is a large, thick-skinned tuber that looks kind of like a long white sweet potato with a coconut skin. It's a major part of the diet in many tropical countries. Yet it contains a precursor to deadly cyanide. Of course, when it's cooked and processed correctly, it can be harmless. So don't go biting down on the next raw cassava plant you see. Not surprisingly, cassava is especially high in cyanide compounds during drought, exactly when it needs additional protection against predators to make it through the growing season. Consider another example, the Indian vetch, which is cultivated in Asia and Africa. Its chemical weapon of choice is a powerful neurotoxin that can cause paralysis. The neurotoxin is so powerful that the vetch can often survive when all other crops die out because of drought or infestation. For that reason, poor farmers in some parts of the world cultivate it as an insurance crop. Insurance against starvation in the event of a famine. And sure enough, the incidence of disease related to this organic poison climbs after a famine in those areas where the vetch is grown. Not surprisingly, some people choose to risk the vetch's poison rather than starve to death. The nightshades are a large group of plants, some edible, some poisonous. All nightshade contains a large portion of alkaloids, chemical compounds that can be toxic to insects and other herbivores and affect humans in ways ranging from helpful to hallucinogenic. Some people speculate that witches included some types of nightshade in their magic ointments and potions and then hallucinated that they were flying. One of the most common members of the nightshade family, which includes potatoes, tomatoes, and eggplant, is the Jimson weed, which got its name from Jamestown, Virginia. About 100 years before the Revolutionary War, there was a short-lived revolt called Bacon's Rebellion. It was defeated pretty quickly, but not without some hiccups along the way. When British soldiers were sent to Jamestown to put down the rebellion, they were secretly, or accidentally, drugged with Jimson weed in their salad. In 1705, Robert Beverly described the result in the History and Present State of Virginia. Some of them ate plentifully of it, the effect of which was a very pleasant comedy, for they turned natural fools upon it for several days. One would blow up a feather in the air, another would dart straws at it with much fury, and another, stark naked, was sitting up in a corner like a monkey, grinning and making mouths at them. A fourth would fondly kiss and paw his companions, and sneer in their faces with a countenance more antic than any in a Dutch droll. 1,000 such simple tricks they played, and after 11 days returned themselves again, not remembering anything that had passed. Jimson weed is a tall green weed with big leaves that is common throughout America. People eat it accidentally every year, usually because it's mixed in with other plants in their garden. Plant chemicals can paralyze, sterilize, or make us crazy. They can also affect us in much milder ways, like interfering with digestion or burning our lips. Wheat, beans, and potatoes all have amylase inhibitors, a class of chemicals that interfere with the absorption of carbohydrates. Protease inhibitors, found in chickpeas and some grains, interfere with protein absorption. Many of these botanical defense systems can be disabled by cooking or soaking. The old world tradition of soaking beans and legumes overnight does exactly that. It neutralizes most of the chemicals that mess with our metabolism. If you've ever bitten down on a raw habanero pepper, you probably felt like you were being poisoned. And you were. That burning sensation is caused by a chemical called capsaicin. Mammals are sensitive to it because it tickles the nerve fibers that sense pain and heat. But birds aren't. And that goes to show just how clever old Mother Nature can be when she's doing the evolution dance. Mice and other rodents that would otherwise be drawn to the fruits of chili plants avoid them because they can't take the heat. That's good for the chili because the digestive systems of mammals destroy its small seeds, a process that pretty much takes the point out of the gastronomic hitchhike. Birds, on the other hand, don't destroy chili seeds when they eat chili peppers, and they aren't affected by capsaicin. So mammals leave the peppers for the birds, and the birds take the seeds to the air, spreading them along the way. Capsaicin is a sticky poison. It adheres to mucous membranes, which is why your eyes burned if you ever rub them after handling peppers. It's also why the heat from a hot pepper sticks around so long, and why water does nothing to cool the burn. Its stickiness acts to prevent capsaicin from easily dissolving in water. You're much better off drinking milk, but this is one time to pass on the skim, or eat something else with fat in it, since fat is hydrophobic. It helps to peel the capsaicin away from your mucous membranes and cool you down. Capsaicin doesn't just cause a burning sensation. It can actually cause selective degeneration of some types of neurons. In large quantities, hot peppers can be very harmful. Scientists are still debating the connection, but people in places like Sri Lanka, where hot peppers are almost a staple, as well as other ethnic groups who eat lots of hot peppers, tend to have much higher rates of stomach cancer. From an evolutionary perspective, it's not surprising that plants have evolved mechanisms to ensure that their predators think twice before making them their next meal. What's more surprising is why we continue to cultivate and consume thousands of plants that are toxic to us. The average human eats somewhere between 5 and 10,000 natural toxins every year. Researchers estimate that nearly 20% of cancer-related deaths are caused by natural ingredients in our diet. So if many plants we cultivate are toxic, why didn't we evolve mechanisms to manage those toxins, or just stop cultivating them? Well, we have. Sort of. How many times have you had a craving for something sweet, or something salty? How about something bitter? Can't you just see yourself saying, "Oh man, all I really want is something really bitter."